السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. Spiritual abuse is the misuse of religion. It encompasses sexual assault, exploitation, manipulation, financial abuse. The first incident I always like to start with is the first incident that we know of, which was of Adam alayhi salam, his wife, and Shaitan. So Adam alayhi salam in Jannah was told not to eat from a certain tree, right? And Shaitan came and said, وَقَاسَمَهُمَا الشَّيْطَانَ. So Allah promised them, like came with a straight face and assured them that إِنِّي لَكُمَا لَمِنَ النَّاصِحِينَ, that I am to both of you, meaning Adam and Hawa, as a sincere counselor. And that caused Adam alayhi salam to slip and eat from that tree, which he wasn't supposed to do. Now we know that prophets are sinless. They, by definition, cannot commit sin. And they also have something called fatana. Fatana is it's like a genius, it's peak intelligence. They're the smartest of people. Yet Adam alayhi salam was still fooled by Shaitan. So we know that it's not really about intelligence, it's about trust. And even from the goodness of a person, they don't expect others to lie, especially when it comes to religion and taking the name of Allah. And we see that demonstrated in Surah Jinn as well, when the group of jinn heard the Quran being recited by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and they accepted Islam. And in Surah Jinn, it's mentioned the jinn say that وَأَنَّا ظَنَنَّا أَنَّ تَقُولُ الْإِنسُ وَالْجِنُّ عَلَى اللَّهِ كَذِبًا, that the jinn are saying, we never thought that a human or a jinn would say a lie about Allah. So they knew what lies were, they knew what violence was, they knew what all kinds of sin and crime were, but they did not think somebody would take the name of Allah and lie. And this is from the fitrah of a person to not think somebody would lie. So Adam alayhi salam, some of the Mufassirun mentioned that he didn't know what a lie was, or he didn't think somebody would lie as it pertains to Allah. And there's a few other explanations as well. So when you hear hadith about insincere preachers or the punishment of scholars who harm others, I don't want you to ever take that as evidence that scholars or religious preachers could do something bad. If that is evidence for you, you're not learning the right lesson. Those hadith and the ayahs in Quran about people who have knowledge and don't practice it, that's not substantiating the existence of such people. It's a warning against them. The reason you should believe it happens is because you're alive. It's that simple. Only prophets are perfect. Everybody else is not just fallible, but normal, very prone to sin like anybody else. So it should come as no surprise. I don't want anybody to ever say, I'm shocked such and such a person could do such a thing. They're a sheikh. How could they do it? The fact is they're human. That's why. So when you think of somebody as higher, it should be proven repeatedly and earned. So trust is always to be earned, and it's not by position. If somebody has a religious position, that should not mean you trust them any less, right? Any more or any less. So what we go by as Muslims is something called Zahirul Adala, which is their outward appearance. So if somebody on the by all outward standards, by what you can see, is doing nothing wrong, they're just, for example, teaching Quran, teaching Hadith, you can't assume anything negative about them or think that they're more prone to do something bad than anybody else. But at the same time, you shouldn't think any higher of them just because of their position. So this is just a fancy way of saying that everybody starts with a clean slate. So just as you would have a biology teacher or any other subject, you don't get into their personal life, you just take them for what they are, but you don't build on that relationship without reason. So for example, when asked, who do you trust? The answer is yourself. You trust yourself in how to have a healthy relationship. So for example, you have friends and colleagues and other teachers that you trust at a basic level. They're not jumping out to harm you. Do you give anybody your email passwords? Do you give them your credit card information? So what does it mean to trust somebody? There's boundaries, right? Ultimately, that's why it goes back to trusting yourself. So when behavior gets sketchy, you have to be the one to set up those boundaries. One example with inappropriate touching that happens is we will have male teachers touching women on their hijabs and saying, well, it's not skin to skin, so it's not technically wrong, you know? And the response to that is, I don't care if it's halal or haram, I just don't allow that for myself, personal standard. And this also happens when it comes to inappropriate touch with men to men. Sometimes it'll be under ruqya, which is like a spiritual healing or blessing. So somebody's saying, I want to bless you and protect you from evil forces. So they'll recite Quran and then inappropriately touch people. And this has happened to imams, okay? So a lot of religious manipulation, we also have to understand this happens to religious leaders themselves. So the theme of this conference is khidmah. So I wanted to focus this presentation on khidmah and how khidmah is exploited, and begin with giving gifts as it, and segue into khidmah. So the Prophet ﷺ said, "Tahadu tahabu," exchange gifts and love will, and it'll foster love between you. The Prophet ﷺ, he accepted and exchanged gifts, but it's not enough to just say that the Prophet said "Tahadu tahabu," and that it's from his sunnah not to turn down a gift, to say, okay, now we should just give gifts and accept gifts. Understanding that, you have scholars outlining what's appropriate and what's not. And I'm drawing today from the work of Maulana Ashraf Ali Thanwi in his book on etiquettes of social interactions. One thing he mentions on giving gifts is that if you wish to give a gift to someone, then do not ask them for a favor. Because giving that gift and then asking for a favor puts undue pressure on the individual. And it's closer to a bribe than it is a gift. Because a gift should be with clean heart, meaning there should be no ulterior motives. And it should just be on muhabba, like love, free of any secondary intention or ulterior motive. He says that to ask for a favor after giving a gift is a type of a bribery. And then second, he mentions, don't even mention a need. Because if you mention a need you have, like give a gift to somebody and say, you know, I'm going through hard times, I'm going through some financial difficulty, you put that seed in the person where they are drawn more towards you through the gift, and now you're asking for a favor. It's putting undue pressure. Now, as Muslims, we believe that we're all mukallaf, if we're sane, adult, and awake, but it's not that we're saying the person is not morally responsible anymore, but we recognize undue pressure. So just like shaitan, he whispers to people to do bad things. We recognize that, right? And shaitan is punished for those whisperings and for those insinuations. Yet, the devil made me do it is not an excuse in Islam. So we don't say, I have nothing to do with it, the devil told me to do it. So it's both. There's individual responsibility, but we also recognize that there's undue pressure and there's influence. So this is what Maulana Ashraf Ali Thanwi is talking about. And he also mentions a third condition, to give a gift with the motive to obtain some benefit. So, for example, you think you're going to get a promotion or be, you know, given a better position in something if you give a gift to somebody. That's not doing it with a pure heart anymore. There's an ulterior motive. And, you know, honestly, I had people who would come to town doing religious events and who would tell me things like, look, and show me their Facebook messages. Look, I messaged this person saying, miss you, Siddi. And now this person's exciting that I'm coming because he looks up to me as a religious teacher and he's happy that I gave them that intention. Now watch what I'm going to do. I'm going to do a fundraiser in this person's house because I already opened his heart to me. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, I saw it happen. And some of them would even tell me, like, buy coffee for people, because when you buy a $3 cup of coffee for somebody, you're now getting loyalty from that person. So what's $3 for loyalty? They're kind of exploiting that reaction, the very human reaction of love coming out of exchanging gifts, right? So in healthy relationships, tahadu tahabu, it's a very good way to go. Exchange gifts, foster love. But at the same time, knowing gifts bring about love, people will exploit that love that's being built and exploit the fact that they're looked up to. Now this relates to khidmah, because khidmah, as I'm sure you're learning in the other sessions of this conference, is a very important and vital part of this religion, right? But khidmah should also have conditions, and we should understand healthy and unhealthy khidmah. So khidmah is healthy when you're doing it sincerely. Sincerely means for Allah, but also not to gain status from in that group or love from any individuals. So even if somebody else isn't exploiting you for that, you could be exploiting yourself, right? Zalimun li nafsi. That's a category we have. Somebody who's oppressing their own selves, even if nobody else is. And you should feel no pressure. There should be no expectation of you to volunteer. The ones you volunteer for should recognize it as an honor. And there should be no negative consequences to not doing khidmah. You should be free to walk away. So three conditions that Maulana Ashraf Ali Thanwi mentions on khidmah. He mentions one, sincerity, that it's not a medium to attain other motives, right? Another one is that you know somebody and there's a relationship already established. So this goes to teachers as well and people of status, that if somebody comes and is just offering services and they don't know you, you should actually ask them, like, why do you want to volunteer for me? Why do you want to help me? And like, look out for other people that they're not volunteering under any false perception they may have. And the third is just knowing the person, knowing what they're doing. Also, khidma and rank. So if somebody of high rank, if you're using somebody of high rank and say, this person told me that I should come to you for help, you shouldn't do that either, because now they feel some sort of social pressure to please that person of high rank. Or they may fear negative consequences, whether it's from the government or just somebody of high standing, their reputation suffering as a result, it's their employer. So social pressure, again, is recognized, and that should not be in the discussion of khidma. It should be completely with a, like, what's called tibu nafs, just no ulterior motives, no other type of pressure. Now, this gets into the story of Prophet Musa alayhi salam and Khidr. So also a part of this theme of the conference of Khidma and Khidr and Musa, right? So why did Prophet Musa seek out Khidr alayhi salam? Because Allah told him to, right? That's first and foremost. And then with the intention of learning from him, seeking knowledge. Yet when Prophet Musa went to Khidr alayhi salam, what did he say? Hal atabi'uka, like, may I follow you? Ala an tu'allimani mimma 'allamta rushda, so that you may teach me what you've learned from knowledge and guidance. A few points from that mentioned are that although Allah commanded Musa alayhi salam to go seek Khidr, Musa alayhi salam, when he saw Khidr, he didn't say, Allah sent me. Going back to the previous point of not making anybody feel pressure, that this is coming from a higher source and you have to listen, right? He went very humbly and just approached him as somebody who approaches somebody when they're seeking a favor themselves. So that makes Khidr al-Islam free to say no, because he's not invoking Allah. Second, he's not invoking himself. He's not invoking the fact that he's a prophet and one of the best of prophets, right? Highest ranking of prophets. He's not saying, I'm Musa alayhi salam, I'm the one to whom the Torah was revealed. I demand that you teach me. He doesn't say, I'm a prophet. He doesn't say, Allah sent me. What does that empower Khidr alayhi salam to say? He put conditions on him. That you can follow me as long as you don't ask for a thing that I did, why did I do it? That's a healthy relationship. And then what ends up happening by the end of the story, Khidr alayhi salam feels free to act on what he said, and he says, this is where we part ways, because Musa alayhi salam asked questions, right, that he wasn't supposed to. That's an example of how a service relationship is supposed to be, not invoking any type of position and a lot of mutual respect. And it becomes unhealthy when gaining closeness to a religious figure position is a goal of the khidmah, or you feel like you'll be left out if you don't, or you feel your status with God depends on it. So I'm not saying that this is abuse, but it's just an unhealthy framework. Next is red flags for abuse in khidmah. And this is something to really pay attention to, because if you volunteer in organizations or for individuals and you ignore this, even if later on you could say, but I did it for the sake of Allah and I'll be rewarded, it's going to leave a deep resentment in you. And God is not a consolation prize, right? I mean, just like you volunteer for Allah, stand up for yourself and honor yourself for the sake of Allah as well. For example, we know that if you die defending your wealth, you die as a martyr. That's not love of dunya, right? It's understanding that our rights are sacred and we have a duty to defend ourselves, and our honor is included in that. So if a person is made to feel or thinks themselves that their khidma is reflective of their status with God, that's a very serious problem. The group, the individual, and the service become blurred. So the organizational goals and service to the individual are one and the same. These are very personality-oriented Islamic organizations, and they're a dime a dozen, and you'll find them all over. Having young women doing laundry for them at 3 a.m. and dropping stuff off and picking stuff up. And it's just, it goes unchecked completely. A lot of times because these people are high performers, they do a lot of good for the community as well. A person might be guilted, insulted, or made fun of for not doing khidmah. So they're not being honored anymore. It's not a healthy relationship. There's a lot of pressure to do khidmah. something to pay really attention to is, are you lying to your parents, friends, or other people about how much volunteering you're doing? Would it be something you're embarrassed or feel ashamed about if people knew how much you're volunteering into this organization? And always know that these organizations will quite easily dispose of you, you know, if problems come up. And if you're volunteering in a way where you think you're building some lifelong relationship, that reality can come crashing down very quickly, you know. So always volunteer in a way where you won't feel burned or betrayed when that happens. Another red flag is if you're not respected as a volunteer, and donors are respected a lot more. So donors, they're harder to replace, and people know that. And volunteers, people doing khidmah at lower levels, are treated as very disposable people in these abusive scenarios. And if that's happening, you know that the organization is not upholding their espoused beliefs, where everybody's important, everybody has their sanctity, and everybody plays their part, right? So the donors are catered to a lot more. And when you see that and you're being disrespected in ways a donor would never be, you know it's a larger issue and you know it's targeted as well. They know who they can do that to and who they can't do that to. And lastly, if there's ever a task or service that's deemed menial and the leadership won't want to do themselves and just assign somebody else to do. So for example, if it's cleaning a bathroom, it better be a rotation of everybody doing that one day. And the leaders better feel no shame to clean bathrooms as well. They can't say things like, oh, I have more important things to do, because that concept shouldn't exist, especially when it comes to more menial labor. Now, some reasons we might volunteer in settings that even we know are abusive. One is to belong. One common human need that's unfortunately exploited is the need to belong. So you'll have Muslims who are perhaps bullied in other areas, outcasted in other social groups, but they find a Muslim organization that they're not outcasts in. And they'll be bullied, but put up with it, treated very bad, exploited, put up with it just to have a group to belong to. And they can't stand to also not to lose this group now. And people are very conscious of that, right? They're aware of that, but it doesn't really matter because, again, the narcissistic personality or groups that have this sort of way of operating will just see people as tools. They don't really care. Another reason would be to gain access to teachers and learning. Of course, it's important to learn and to learn from teachers. However, if the price for that is a khidmah, is service, and it's not done in a healthy way, meaning it's an overload, you don't feel like you can say no, you're asked like randomly to do different things and there's punishments for not doing it, it's not a good way of attaining those lessons or closeness to the teachers and learning. Because they're now setting up that you need sohbah, you need to study with these teachers, but they're also making this the price in exchange for that. So they're kind of making this whole system that you have to go through, and the benefit now is just getting a few classes or lessons. Another reason may be to be part of an inner circle. So it's like almost like a type of hazing, where to get closer to the teachers and to gain more knowledge and companionship, you have to do a lot of work no one else is willing to do. Now, how people are manipulated for khidmah. One is being invited to special gatherings or events as long as they're doing that service. Creating circles in groups and out groups, and always having to earn your place in the in-group, and that being earned through service. Another would be using statements on the importance of service to teachers and really emphasizing that if you don't serve your teachers, full real examples would be that you'll die in kufr. You know, you'll die as a non-Muslim if you don't serve your teachers. Whoever doesn't thank people hasn't thanked Allah. And then just putting really ridiculous standards of what it means to thank people and to serve the deen. And again, serving the religion becomes synonymous with serving an individual. And anytime that happens, you're in the wrong place. And then people being told they're not sincere if they're not serving. So service should always be a two-way street of mutual respect. And then a way people are also abused in khidmah is guilting for not serving Allah more, being told more than you can bear, giving unreasonable tasks, and then giving really harsh treatment to people for doing tasks, overloading them, and saying this is to break your nafs. So anytime complaints are brought up, well, this is your spiritual edification. You need to break your nafs. This is to snap your ego. And again, there are people from all levels, the most intelligent, successful people, who out of their religious sincerity will fall for this and go through a lot of abuse out of religious sincerity. I think the most prominent example we have of that in modern times is Malcolm X. No one would deny his intelligence. Very tough person. Heavily manipulated in religion. And it was his own, as in his own words, his religious sincerity that made him turn a blind eye to many things.
So, I have the same question is like, yeah. We know that we have to study religion and the teacher, but we can't study Bible. So then how do you keep that in the back of your mind? And also, you kind of have to trust your teacher too.
Right. So trust, what does trust mean? That's exactly what we're talking about, right? So trusting a religious teacher, it would be just like trusting any other teacher, like a biology teacher. You get your class, no strings attached, you don't need to do any khidmah. It's very clear from the beginning what the rules are. You study, you're taught, and that's it. You don't need a personal relationship. Now, the more somebody gets involved, it should be predetermined in a person's mind what their limits are. So, and don't make excuses for anything that you would recognize as wrong otherwise. So don't let the religious status or that relationship justify anything that's shady. For example, if there's any touch or any haram or even flirtatious behavior. Does anyone know what a pickup artist is? Yeah, it's like people, yeah, I only know, I have to research this stuff. But like, it's people who like teach people how to have relationships and like pick up on women. So one thing that people will do, and this is very unfortunately common, is saying things like, you know, we should go out and see the sun and see the sunrise and just say to like one lady. But then after saying it to her and kind of putting that image in her mind, saying like, yeah, it'd be good for the class to see when like Fajr ends, for example. You know, and then like playing those games or say, oh, you're really beautiful, mashallah. You know, you pray a lot. And then you get the person confused as to whether it's inner beauty that you're talking about or outward beauty. And I promise you this stuff works and breaks down barriers. And some of the most self-blame you have is from people, but I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, how could I fall for this, you know? And it's not about intelligence, it's just you don't expect people to be that predatory. But to answer your question, it's just like any other teacher, and you trust yourself. So we trust our friends, but we don't give them our passwords to our emails, right? You have limits all the time. Ultimately, you have to trust your better judgment. You never go on autopilot with anybody. Some real examples is someone I know actually being told to drop out of college to serve their sheikh. They thought a lot about it, but didn't do it. It was actually UC Davis, a student going to UC Davis. This was like years ago, but this was the college. And another person worked a very good job, and he was often late to work serving his sheikh, and his sheikh would tell him, what's more important, dunya or deen? And that person was deen. Again, a successful individual, and kept being late, and was told, if you keep coming late, we're going to have to let you go. And the sheikh said, well, this is your crossroads, dunya or deen. And luckily, thankfully, the person chose dunya, quote unquote, right? And that was the point of breaking away. And this also happens in marriages. You know, be my Khadija, support me financially, you know. And unfortunately, also people who are targeted for a lot of khidmah, and this is an ugly reality, but are unmarried middle-aged women. And they're targeted, and I'm saying this from based on conversations. Also, Danya, the co-founder, told me that when she was volunteering, teachers reached out to her saying, we need to find women who aren't married because they just married their organization. And that's like a lot, and like laughing about that. So that's how wicked some of this stuff gets, you know. So other examples are teachers calling their students, or do you know what a murid is? Like a spiritual disciples, someone that gave bayah to them. It happens both in Sufi tariqas and outside. But calling them in the middle of the night, are you praying for me or not? Why are you sleeping? You're not serious about this relationship if you're not up praying for me right now. We're supposed to be on the higher spiritual path. Things of that nature. And you know, and it really messes with people. What are some things we can do about it for khidmah? One is have your boundaries set. This goes for any relationship. But know how much you want to give. Know that you're doing it out of the goodness of your heart. Be humble, but at the same time, recognize you're doing a favor to the organization. And have the attitude that what you're doing is good for you, but also a way of benefiting others, so you deserve to be respected, and your dignity is sacred. So the Prophet said, the believer does not belittle himself. So just like you would serve for the sake of Allah, don't belittle yourself either and do that for the sake of Allah. Stand up for yourself. We don't believe in a clergy class in the sense of people being of a higher rank or higher caliber. There are people who are more learned and we learn from them, but that's it. Those are the boundaries, you know. And if somebody is a role model, you should have a justification for why you took somebody as a role model. You better know this person quite well and have tested his character, and then you see them as an example. But even then, there's never going on autopilot, right? You always use your better judgment. Understand that young professionals are targeted. So one of the common themes is getting your own group of young professionals to support your cause. And when that happens, know also that if you're in those circles, that you're probably going to see the best side of such figures, because you're the donors, right? And donors are taken care of. So this happens as well to people who organize conferences, getting your brand out there, getting a slot speaking, getting a good slot preferably, being invited to different places where you can expand your brand. That's all social capital. So people of that social capital are going to see the best side of these individuals. So just like predators in other areas groom individuals and parents for access, likewise, people who even just want to explode for financially or to amass followers will groom people in the right position to continue to be invited to conferences and perpetuate their own brand. So now, a key thing to look at is the prophetic example. The Prophet ﷺ, he didn't have people just doing things for him. So we know in Khandaq, the Battle of the Trenches, he was in there digging trenches with everybody. There was never this example of, I'm the Prophet, do this for me. That's not how the Prophet ﷺ lived. And the Nabiyyu awla bil mu'minina min anfusihim. The Prophet is a priority to the believers even before they are to themselves. What does that mean? One of the meanings of that is that when a Muslim died in debt, the Prophet would pay off their debt. So he took responsibility for the debt a Muslim had, and they died with that debt, and if they couldn't pay it off. So this wasn't perks. This isn't just a leader who has perks. This is somebody who takes responsibility of those who follow him. Sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Also, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he would walk behind his sahaba. Like when they would walk in rank, he'd walk behind them. One reason is he would say, leave my back for the angels, because the angels, and it's honoring the angels, although they could still fit. It's just giving them a lot of space. But also, it's out of his humility. And we know that the Prophet would look more to the ground, for example, than to the sky. And the reason is he was a very contemplative person. And it's the example of humble people to look more down than to look up and look around. He was not the glorified extrovert. So when we talk about charismatic figures, there's a prophetic and saintly charisma that's very different than the celebrity charismatic persona. So the Prophet was charismatic through his spiritual state, through his actions, through his speech. It penetrated people's hearts. But not as some extrovert who always was the funniest and life of the party type individuals we might think when we hear the word charisma. Anas radiallahu anhu served the Prophet for 10 years. And he said, the Prophet never said to me for a thing that I did, why did you do it? He never said for something I didn't do, why didn't you do it? And Allah says, lower your wing to those who follow you from amongst the believers. So that's the prophetic way of leadership. It's leading by example. One really important thing to area, and the most common, is financial abuse. So this is something to look into always. Zakat. Anytime you donate to an organization, you should see a transparent process. And if you don't have the process, never trust the individual. And this is, again, the most common type of abuse. And don't fall for simple tricks such as associations. People who have causes will find the right religious figures or friends of theirs who are trusted. They may not be in on it at all, right? But they just don't assume that there's any fraud going on. So if you see this person does great work or has testimonials, that's not a process. Always look for a process. And just to quickly go through, I mean, some simple examples are of zakat. One of the categories is fi sabilillah, for the sake of Allah, which could extend to education. So what some organizations will do is like have retreats, have camps or events that are $10 a person, $20 a person, but they'll sponsor tickets. And those seats that they're sponsoring might be $1,000 a person, because you can arbitrarily set a price. Speaker gets maybe like a $100 honorarium. And the rest of the money that they sponsored through zakat is thousands of dollars in zakat revenue they collected to now go back to operations for the organization. So it's no longer zakat. Once it gets back to the organization, it's not zakat anymore. Does that make sense? So it's using zakat as a funnel for personal funds or for organizational funds. Very common, always look for a process. And some people will even like train their students to do this. Put out a box or even on your website, a madrasa you're building or a library for this school, and then say click to donate. But you're not saying the donations are going to this cause. You're saying that they say that we're not responsible for any associations people make. If they think that click here means for this cause, that's their responsibility. We didn't say that. So your sadaqah is still accepted because you gave it for the right intention. However, you've been cheated, right? And what I'm trying to say is Allah accepting it should not serve as a compensation to the point where we overlook the larger abuse and work towards seeing a process. Also, we have to recognize that that's a con. And the way to prevent that really is transparency. It's the only way. So if you're just seeing testimonials like so-and-so benefited from these classes, they're going to use causes people care for. So for example, some advertising will be interracial couples because that's stuff Muslims like to see. Like, oh, finally, we're seeing interracial Muslim couples. You know, we're progressing. Or female scholarship. Support female scholarship. Now give the gift of light, but there's no transparency in where that money is going. And people in those organizations know just how corrupt it is financially. But they'll say, we're supporting a female scholarship. And everybody likes that cause. It's an important cause. It really is. But they're using those good causes to take away your critical thinking and understanding that there needs to be a process. All we can really do is insist on a process when we donate, because there are countless ways of con artistry. So just really quickly to go through some signs that you are prey. If you trust someone, you'll give money without seeing a process. These are all signs you're prey. Or if you don't feel empowered to ask for your money back if you give somebody a loan. It's your money, it's your right, you should feel entitled to do so. If you trust somebody or see as validation someone doing an event with another religious figures or them working along with one another. Never take that social proof as validation. Or if someone, if you don't have the legal argument and someone does something that you know is wrong and they wouldn't do in public, that you will accept it as a justification. A lot of abuse that happens in private would be behaviors that are not acceptable for the public. So don't accept a justification that's given in private. Or you're making excuses for why someone disrespects you. Once you begin psychoanalyzing, you're never going to get out of that cycle. Don't psychoanalyze why somebody does something. Just focus on the behavior and recognize that needs to change. If you freeze in confrontations, that's something to work on as well, becoming more assertive. If you believe in safe spaces or safe people, that's a big problem. One of the big cons, because con artists, they follow trends. People are looking for these alleged safe spaces and safe people, so they're going to say, let's talk about our pain, let's be open, we can trust one another, everybody's welcome, this is an inclusive space. And those places, I mean, they're just as potentially abusive as others, you know. And you can have 90% of people happy and just 10% are being treated like trash. And those 90% vouch for what are just rumors, right? What are said to just be rumors. So the PR always works in the person's favor. Last one is if you're confused that a person is also does good, right? So no one's completely evil, no one's completely good. The good somebody does, the benefit they've given you is irrelevant to behaviors that are abusive. Always keep that in mind. Whenever you're learning from a human conduit, there's going to be good and there's going to be bad. Good doesn't justify the bad. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.